We're going to bring the Host Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee to order. Representative Considine, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, sir. I move we adopt them.
Representative Considine moves the minutes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails, and minutes are adopted. Folks, today we have an informational hearing on non-ferrous mining in the state of Minnesota. And we have a number of folks that would like to testify to that issue. We've got a lot of people from the public that have signed up. What we're going to do today is we're going to hear from the mining industry and some folks connected with that, and we'll have a certain amount of time allotted to them, and we'll take questions for them. And then after they're all done, then we'll hear some testimony and let some folks from the public voice their opinions. And we have a number of people that wanted to speak, so we've allotted 2 minutes for everybody that has signed up and called in, and we'll take those folks in order that they called in. And that's for and against, pro and con. So, and when we want to be fair about this, we get a number of calls from people that say, well, you've given industry so much time, we want to have equal time. So when we reach that equal amount of time, we'll end the hearing for the day. So with that, we have Mr. Frank Ungaro with us, and please state your name and who you represent for the record, and we'll start our testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Frank Ungaro. I'm the Executive Director of Mining Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk about the exciting opportunity in front of Minnesota with non-ferrous mining. I'm going to give an overview, and a couple other people are going to give some individual comments about individual companies. I have a lot of slides.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Angaro, you're going to have to speak into the mic. Is that what you had,
yes.
Representative Russo? Thank you. Please continue.
I'll run through the slides quickly and move things along. First, it's important to remember that Minnesota has and does support mining. It's a policy of the state to provide for the diversification of the state's mineral economy through the support and development of mining. And the business of mining, producing, or beneficiating non-ferrous metallic minerals is declared to be in the public interest and necessary to the public welfare. And for good reason, in Minnesota, we have non-ferrous metals. Copper, nickel, platinum, palladium, cobalt, gold, titanium. And I'm focusing on the Duluth complex, but also in the Emily area, we have manganese and big deposits of that as well. A lot of companies have a presence and interest in the state of Minnesota. Polybet Mining, Twin Metals, Rio Tinto, Vermilion Gold, Teck, Cardero, Cooperative Mineral Resources, the list goes on. There are a couple others who aren't on here that have a smaller presence in the state of Minnesota as well. And we have a lot of the metals. Over 4 billion tons already identified of low-grade base and precious metals. And every time these companies dig another hole in the ground, drill another hole in the ground, excuse me, the metallurgy comes up positive, and that number grows and grows and grows. First, there's a few things that have to that's worth pointing out of how we got to the point of having mineral development. Companies have to lease, prospect, and explore before you start defining an ore body and moving to a project development. And in Minnesota, with the state-owned minerals, there are mineral leases that companies apply for. With federal minerals, there are prospecting permits that companies apply to the BLM and the Department of Interior with the support of the Forest Service for the surface. And then companies go forward exploring, filing plans of operation. And we've been doing this for a long time in the state of Minnesota. We've had non-ferrous metallic mineral leases for nearly 50 years. There's been over 3,000 leases, and there are about 400 of them are active. Companies usually turn back a lease after a number of period of years after they've looked at the property and determined whether or not there's any mineralization they want to explore for, and most of them last 10 years or less. Companies file that plan of operation with the state or federal agencies, depending upon whether they're state or federal minerals, and depending upon the surface and the surface owners. And we have drilled over 3,000 holes in the state of Minnesota with over hundreds of miles of drill core. This has already provided many jobs in the region, hundreds of millions of dollars of economic benefit, and essentially exploration doesn't rise to the level of environmental review. A year later, after a hole is closed or temporarily closed, it's darn hard to find them, except that the state requires they be marked. Nonetheless, the industry takes this practice of prospecting, exploring very seriously, and looks at best management practices. All of you have a copy of the best management practices booklet in your packet. For the audience, we have that available in an electronic version online on our website at, you can see it on the screen, miningminnesota.com. So what do we have in the Duluth Complex? We have a world-class deposit of global significance. We are sitting on the second largest deposit of copper in the world, folks, with 34% of our U.S. domestic resource. The third largest nickel deposit with nearly all of our U.S. resource. And the second largest platinum group metal deposit with approximately 75% of our domestic resource. This is a copy of the map that the DNR put up the other day, just a reminder of where these deposits are, adjacent to, next to, right alongside of the existing iron formation with Encampment and Cardero and Prime Meridian, the Polymet North Met Project and Tech American's Mesabi deposit right under the largest part of the Peter Mitchell mine, which is near Babbitt. And further north and east, you'll see the Twin Metals projects, and those companies will talk more about their own deposits when they present. So we have it in Minnesota, and now we're moving forward with a lot of companies that want to move towards mineral development. The technology exists in the 21st millennium. The demand is there and growing, and companies are realizing that this is something that they can do and make a profit doing it. Demand is a major driving force. Every baby born in 2014 in America will use over 3 million pounds of minerals, metals, and fuels in their lifetime. And these are the metals that all of us use every day. Look at the metals in this room with our laptops and our cell phones and everything else that goes into the equipment. Our electricity, our plumbing, copper drives a lot of things in our life, including alternative energy. We consume almost 1.9 million tons of copper in this country every year, and we produce 1.2 million tons in 2013. Nickel, stainless steel, food processing equipment, medical devices, you can't have them without it. Again, alternative energies. We consume over 200,000 tons in this country, and in 2013, we had zero production. The Eagle Mine in Michigan, the state of Michigan just permitted the Eagle Mine that has just started up, so we will see some nickel production certainly in 2015 from the Eagle Mine. Platinum, we produce 3,000 kilograms, and we consume 80,000 kilograms. Catalytic converters taking air emissions out of our automobiles. All important essential metals that we are import dependent on. Many of the metals on the top, you can see we are 100% import dependent on a variety of metals. That includes manganese. We are 79% import dependent on platinum, 48% I believe on copper, 36 on copper, 48 on nickel, and this is after scrap. We are doing a tremendous job of recycling our scrap. 80,000 tons a year of nickel recycled, but we're still importing hundred plus thousand tons of nickel, 170,000 tons of copper recycled in 2013, but we're still importing 800,000 tons of copper. So we are import dependent, and we have these metals right here in Minnesota. So with the metals, with the interest, we are attracting investment to the state of Minnesota, and that's a positive thing. The Fraser Institute puts out a report every other year that looks at how jurisdictions are viewed as attractiveness to an investment, and we're moving up. We're 35th out of 112 jurisdictions, but there's still 20 countries and six states ahead of us. We're in the lower middle part of the right-hand column there between Namibia and Tasmania. And we've got room to improve, but we're doing well. We used to be in the lower left-hand side below Zimbabwe, so things are getting better. So if all this positive activity exists in the state, why is there even an issue around non-ferrous mining? Well, mineral deposits contain sulfides. And if you leave them exposed to both air and water, you have to have both, they're going to generate acidity. And if you don't deal with that properly, it can do some pretty terrible stuff to water. And that's important to recognize, know, and address. And that's called risk. And we have risk in everything we do every day in our lives. And we believe that's why we have regulations. And we believe we have a couple positive things going in the state of Minnesota for the copper nickel development. And the first and very important one is that the Duluth complex is largely sulfur deficient. Very low amounts of sulfur in the deposit, single digits, 1-2% for the vast majority of the ore that we have in the Duluth complex. In fact, the commissioner of the DNR, when PolyMet Supplemental EIS came out at a press conference, announced that the PolyMet project will not generate acid rock drainage in its project. Now, every project's going to be different. Every project's going to have a unique deposit, a unique defined ore body is going to be looked at and assessed in a separate environmental review, how they're going to handle their tailings and their waste and what their exposure is, what their risk is, and how to mitigate that impact that gets identified by the state. But in Minnesota, clearly, we believe that this is certainly a difficult place to permit a mine. All you have to do, again, is look at the only project that has moved into the environmental development stage, and that's PolyMet, and how long it has taken. It's a lengthy, thorough, open, transparent, and costly process. But we support that process. We believe that Minnesota has a reputation of getting things done right and getting them done right the first time. And we can be a model for the rest of the country and the world and move forward with responsible mining. All the regulations and standards in Minnesota are clearly in place. We have solid air, water quality standards, and our Minnesota taxpayers are protected. Non-ferrous rules and statutes were promulgated in the 90s with all stakeholders participating at the table. And we have a comprehensive, thorough coverage of standards and regulations in place to cover non-ferrous mining. And investors are also seeing that there are some successful models of operations of non-ferrous mining to point toward. Right next door in the state of Wisconsin, in the 90s, the Flambeau mine operated for just under 10 years, has been closed for about 15 years now, and the state of Wisconsin, Department of Natural Resources, holds it up as a model operation, a model closure, successful non-ferrous operation right next door. It had no permit violations during its entire operation, no permit violations, closure or post-closure. There were a variety of lawsuits, but ultimately the Flambeau operation, the appellate court judges found that they were in compliance with the Clean Water Act, and in their narrative even praised the company for their commitment to protection of the environment. Other operations, Stillwater Mine has developed a good neighbor policy with environmental and conservation groups. The Eagle Mine, which I mentioned, is just recently permitted in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The Safford projects in Arizona have been operating since 2007, 2008 with very stellar records, no violations. So we have a lot of things to look toward, learn from, and use as we look at how to do it even better here in the state of Minnesota. Clearly, mining is essential for our future. for the way of life that we want to see, and certainly for the green economy. We, in a modern society, cannot have a clean environment without mining. In a modern society, we cannot have a clean environment without mining. We all want the same thing. We all want to see alternative energies. We want to see hybrid cars. We want to see electric cars. A regular car has just under 50 pounds of copper. A hybrid car, about 75 pounds of copper. An electric car, somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 pounds of copper. A 3 megawatt wind turbine, over 4 tons of copper. We need these metals in order to move the economy forward. You can't move solar without copper to move it as well. And this all comes with the tremendous benefit of the economics that goes along with it. And we clearly have and can continue to have and will have for generations jobs and a clean environment. We all too often hear this industry and the development efforts characterized as jobs versus the environment. We believe that's a false premise. We've been mining for 100 years. We have mining and we have a good environment. And we have strong regulations in place, and we believe that that can continue to happen for generations to come because we have a deposit that can sustain operations for generations to come. And these economic benefits are they're tremendous. The University of Minnesota Duluth has done a number of studies. They looked at, in addition to the PolyMet Direct jobs that you'll hear about, they estimated another 600 spinoff jobs in St. Louis County alone, and they'll be pumping $250 million annually into the economy of northeastern Minnesota and even more into the entire state. Mining already represents 30% of our region's gross domestic product. We believe we can double the size of the existing industry and grow that pie rather than try and replace that. With this industry is going to come addition of thousands of high-paying jobs, thousands of spin-off supplier-vendor jobs, and millions and millions of hours of upfront construction jobs. Mining wages are real. These are the Bureau of Labor Statistics 2013 wages, with mining across the country averaging $72,000 annually. And all other industries combined, $49,700. In parentheses to the right are the Minnesota numbers, where mining wages are even a little higher compared to the slightly higher Minnesota industry-wide, all industry average. Again, in 2012, the Labovitz School of Economics at the University of Minnesota Duluth campus did an economic impact study of ferrous and non-ferrous mining. And when it looked at the potential non-ferrous projects that are on the horizon, it looked at the opportunity for an additional $2+ billion into our economy each and every year, with another 5,000 plus jobs as a result of that. And if you add the capitalization of these operations at about $5 million, and again, the multiple millions of hours of construction, building, and trades and labors for however number of years those capitalization operations need to take place to come to completion, that number grows significantly. Tax revenue to both local governments and to the state are tremendous opportunities, literally tens of millions of dollars each year to local city schools and towns and counties, and tens of millions of dollars each year to the state general fund. Copper nickel mining, non-ferrous mining, will pay a net proceeds tax that, similarly to the taconite production tax, will be shared within the region, and they will pay an occupation tax similar to the existing iron ore industry, essentially its corporate franchise tax, and those dollars will go directly to the state's general fund. In addition, the Department of Natural Resources has estimated that the school trust fund will benefit to the tune of over $2 billion from the operations of the proposed projects across the region that have state-owned school trust fund minerals. And as we all know, those dollars go to help hold down property taxes in every school district across the entire state of Minnesota. We all want the same thing. We all want to keep our air and our water, our lakes, pristine and beautiful for our kids, our grandkids, and generations to come. Those of us in the industry are third, fourth generation rangers who have just as much respect for the environment as anyone else, and we believe we have a win-win-win opportunity to meet the growing demand, do it with Minnesota jobs, do it with Minnesota strict standards, and hold these projects up as environmentalists, each and every one of us, as just that, models for mining, not only domestically, but across the entire world. Mr. Chairman, with that, I will end my presentation. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Angaro. Members, I just want to reiterate that we have a long list of the public that would like to speak, so hopefully we can keep our questions brief and to the point. We want to stick to the agenda as well. We've allowed 5 minutes for questions for Mr. Angaro, so if we have any questions, any members have questions at this time? Okay, very well. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for coming in. Great job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we'll have up Mr. Brad Moore from PolyMet. And folks in the audience, if you don't have a chair, there's a monitor set up in room 181 for overflow viewing. If you'd like to view the proceedings in room 181, you can do that too. Okay, thank you very much for coming to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brad Moore, Executive VP for Environmental and Government Relations for PolyMet.
I'm Tina Pint, the Senior Hydrogeologist and Vice President with Barr Engineering. I've been the Project Manager for the environmental work that our company has done for PolyMet.
Thank you for coming in today.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm going to briefly go over the overview of the project and with a focus on the process in terms of environmental review and permitting and where we're at in that process. So about PolyMet, we're Minnesota-based, publicly traded on the New York and Toronto stock exchanges. We have a single project near Hoyt Lakes. It's a proposed open pit mine and mill with a 20-year permit application. It's a polymetallic resource, copper, nickel, cobalt, and the platinum group metals. It's production of essential metals. This is the annual production numbers, 72 million pounds of copper. You see the nickel, cobalt, and again, ounces of precious metals as well. In terms of the location of the project, you see the blue serpentine line. That's the symbols are the iron mines along the Iron Range, and you'll see the one with the star next to it. Our project proposes to reuse a taconite facility that was shut down in 2001 and build the proposed mine just to the east of that. And we give you a sense geographically where we are. Now, drilling down a little bit more in terms of a closer picture, what you have here in this is to the upper right of the screen, the active North Shore taconite operations. You'll see there over to the left of the screen the large 4-square-mile tailings basin that we propose to reuse in our plant site. And to the lower left of the corner is Mesabi Nugget, which is in operation now. The green and the area that has some color just to the south of the North Shore mine is a proposed mine site in terms of stockpiles and pits. One of the keys to our project is to restore the LTV asset that closed in 2001. This is a picture of the concentrator building, which is about a third of a mile long. And in the background, you see our tailings basin. We plan to reuse this facility. The right side, we see the water, and the left side is full. There's approximately 30 to 40% of that tailings basin's life is unused. We plan to complete that. The heart of where our project is right now is with environmental review. This particular slide shows that we're the different agencies that are involved in the environmental impact statement. The lead for the EIS development are the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the U.S. Forest Service. Those co-lead agencies are actually the ones that run the EIS process and are actually the agencies responsible for writing the EIS document. Some people feel that it's the company that writes it, but it's actually the regulators. Note as well the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA is involved in terms on the air and water side, working closely with the Pollution Control Agency for air and water permits. Tribal governments are official cooperators in that process as well. And then the Department of Health has a small role. In terms of the environmental review process, it's gone on for many years, and we've gone through from a pre-feasibility to scoping to draft EIS, and all the way to the right now where we have a supplemental draft EIS that was produced last spring. That particular document generated 58,000 comments, and the Department of Natural Resources and the coal leads are now in the process of responding to every one of those comments. And in their response to comments, they're written, and there was a lot of work over the past year for the DNR to categorize those comments and determine which ones could be easily responded to, which ones needed a different modeling or new data from, for example, our consultants at Bar Engineering. And that's what's taken the bulk of the time between last year and where we sit today. So we're moving right now in terms of the coal lead agencies tell us there will be a final EIS sometime here in the first half of 2015. And then from there, you work on what's called a state adequacy decision and the federal record of decision. The way to think of those decisions are, for the adequacy decision, it says that the EIS is adequate document in terms of information to inform the permitting process that follows. And for that permitting process that then follows, what happens is there's also public process for those permits as well. So the permit to mine, the air and water permits, for example. As you know, in a hearing last year, there was much discussion about financial assurance. That financial assurance will be a part of the application that we submit to the Minnesota DNR when they ask for it. And the DNR is committed that that financial assurance application will also go on public notice. And that is, members of the public, those who support, those who oppose the project, will have a chance to weigh in on that. And that's what I've got. That's right in terms of our process. So what to look forward in the spring is the EIS coming out sometime in the coming months, and a lot of public discussion and understandably debate about the upcoming permitting process. Mr. Chair, we'll take questions now.
Okay. Members, questions? Representative Enzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moore, would you be willing to share with us a little bit of your personal and professional background? Are you a mining engineer? Have you been involved in other non-ferrous projects around the world? Or just what has been your experience with regard to this project?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my experience is actually, my expertise is in regulation. And so I've spent about 18 years at the Department of Natural Resources, another 2.5 at the Pollution Control Agency as commissioner, and then several years at Bar Engineering as a government relations consultant. So what I do for a living is I work with different entities on helping them move through complex regulatory processes. So I work with, for example, hydrogeologists like Tina Pint. You haven't been promoted yet.
No, not yet.
Okay. Work with her in terms of taking that science and then moving it through those processes.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Urusel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier today, we talked about the additional chemicals that are used in the processing, in particular the potassium amyl xanthate. I wonder if you could talk about what considerations there are going to be for safety for the transport of that through our communities along the way.
Sure. The mine will be required to follow the congressionally mandated Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. The objectives of that Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act are to allow state and local planning for chemical emergencies and to provide for notification of emergency releases of chemicals, and then to address communities' right to know about toxic and hazardous materials.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would add to that is it's my understanding that some of these questions you've asked as a part of the EIS process, which, by the way, we encourage. And so we want to let the committee know that the responses we're giving you are ours, and that the regulators, as they go through those comments, may have a different or enhanced response, and they're the ones that ultimately will have the official decision in terms of how that's addressed.
Representative Urusel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know you've done some more advanced modeling since the draft statement came out. Has the modeling reached the point at which it could predict a time scale over which treatment is going to be needed?
Ms. Pan?
You are correct, Representative, that the modeling has been updated for following the supplemental draft environmental impact statement. The water quality models were designed to make sure that appropriate engineering controls would be in place and not to assess the duration of treatment that would be required.
Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I knew that was true at the time of the draft statement, so that is still true that we don't have any modeling that would let us know how long the treatment is expected to be needed.
Ms. Penn.
Representative, we, representing PolyMet, have not done modeling to address that question. How the co-lead agencies will address it in the final EIS is to be determined.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in addition, that our analysis shows that we'll be moving to passive treatment systems approximately 40 years after the close of mining, moving from active systems.
Representative Mitza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I got a question for whoever would like to answer. Do Minnesota's environmental standards meet or exceed our other standards in either the U.S. domestically here or global standards for this type of activity? And if you could maybe kind of walk us through, in my understanding, I'm asking a leading question so the audience knows, Minnesota has very good standards for this type of activity, and I think it's good to have on record where we set ourselves apart from the rest of the world.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do have world-class standards. I'll give you several examples. Because of our proposed project is near some Class 1 airshed, such as Voyageurs National Park, we have to meet very strict air standards. And so, for example, if you look at a metropolitan area like here in the Twin Cities, the standard we have to meet is much tougher. On the water side, Minnesota is unique in terms of having a wild rice standard that's 10 milligrams per liter. Compare that with the drinking water standard at 250. We had to design the water treatment systems for our project to meet that 10. And in fact, not only do we meet it, but we beat it down to 2 to 3 milligrams per liter. And that particular technology that we're using in terms of membrane, as far as I know, we're the only industrial facility that has worked with regulators, tested water, and proven that we can do this. So Minnesota has extremely tough standards nationally and globally. These are two examples of how we meet them.
Okay. Follow up? Okay, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. I understand that the watershed divides in this region where part of it drains to the north towards the boundary waters and another area flows towards the Lake Superior and South Mississippi watershed. Which side of the watershed is the PolyMet mining operation located on? And then the second question I would ask is, we've heard you and the other testifier comment about low sulfide ores, low concentrations of sulfide, and that they need oxygen and water to become acidic. Could you talk a little bit about how you handle the tailings and how you control that exposure?
Mr. Moore?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, PolyMet sits in the Lake Superior watershed, and we're about 175 river miles from Lake Superior, and we have to actually meet the standards right at our plant boundary. So despite being a far distance from Lake Superior, our interest is not only in protecting Lake Superior, but that entire St. Louis River watershed. Regarding the second part of your question, I'm going to turn that over to Tina.
Thank you. Okay. Representative, the PolyMet project has worked closely with the state and federal regulators on the design of test work for both the tailing and the waste rock. That material has undergone over 9 years of accelerated weathering testing work, which has shown that the tailing does not have the potential to go acidic. There is some waste rock at the mine site that does have the potential to go acidic. That rock will be managed on liners and stored temporarily on the surface. That rock will all be placed subaqueous, in the one of the mined out pits for long-term storage underwater, which significantly reduces the oxidation and the risk that material poses.
And I would, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would add,
Mark,
as a consequence as well, the pit lake, in terms of which is near where that is stored, is also in the pH range of neutral.
Does that hurt us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the fact that the tailings are immersed in water, there's what is the risk of any movement of that acidity into the water table?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the actual tailings are in the pH of neutral. The rock that Ms. Pint was referring to was over at the mine site, and the rock is in a mined out pit, so it would not move. Am I getting to your question?
Thank you.
Okay. Additional questions? Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Moore, I was just wondering, is PolyMet completely in the regulatory process right now, or are you seeking or in need of some sort of legislation?
Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are completely in the regulatory process. We are seeking no changes to state or federal law.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Good job. Thank you for coming in today.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Further clarification from my friend, Representative Hertas. Your question was a good one, and it bugs me every Friday when I go home to see that billboard on 35E complaining about sulfide mining, which is really more of a political statement than anything based on science.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, we'll have Mr. McFarland, Bob McFarland from Twin Metals. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Bob McFarland. I'm Vice President of Public and Government Affairs for Twin Metals, Minnesota.
Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee and provide some information about the Twin Metals project. Twin Metals, Minnesota is a Minnesota company that's pursuing the development of an underground copper, nickel, platinum, palladium, gold, and silver mining project in the Iron Range region of northeastern Minnesota. Recently, Twin Metals became a wholly owned subsidiary of Antofagasta PLC, one of the world's leading copper mining companies. And Twin Metals has offices in St. Paul and in Ely, Minnesota. A word about Antofagasta, who are new owners just a couple of weeks ago. They're a Chilean-based copper mining company. They also have operations in transportation and water distribution. They're one of the top 10 global copper producers in the world with three Chilean mining operations. They're a member of the International Council on Mining and Metals, which is an organization of mining companies and trade associations. It's focused on sustainability and environmental stewardship. Antofagasta brings to Minnesota a very strong balance sheet and world-class technical and operational expertise in the mining industry. And Antofagasta has been part of Minnesota's mining industry since 2010. The Twin Metals project, as I mentioned, is located in the Iron Range region of northeastern Minnesota, and the Duluth Complex, as Frank Ungaro outlined. The specific location of the Twin Metals proposed project is at the northern edge of the Mesabi Iron Range, about 9 miles southeast of the city of Ely, about 11 miles northeast of the city of Babbitt. The Twin Metals project has been under development since the mid-2000s, and just recently we completed a project milestone. We completed a pre-feasibility study in June of last year. A pre-feasibility study, for the committee's information, is really a very broad multi-year study that takes a look at a number of mining concepts for a proposed project, helps define a conceptual mine plan, and then further analyzes that conceptual mine plan to assess its feasibility and economic viability. What a pre-feasibility study is not is a mine plan proposal. That will come later. It is also not a definitive environmental document. We have not reached that stage. So some of the types of questions that Representative Yaruso and other members of the committee were asking of PolyMet, we have not reached that stage of environmental definition in our project, and that will come later on in the process. Following the pre-feasibility study, we will go into further detailed engineering, economic analysis, and environmental analysis of the conceptual mine plan, and that will lead to changes to that plan, for almost for certain. Some of them minor, some may be major. But there are certain givens within our mine project that are worth noting. One is that the project is an underground mine project and will remain an underground mine project. The other is that the project is going to produce copper and nickel concentrates. And the third is that the project, in whatever configuration it eventually takes, will meet state and federal environmental standards or won't be allowed to proceed. And over the long term, what this process will do, it will lead Twin Metals to the development and the submittal of a formal mine plan proposal to state and federal regulatory agencies for environmental review. The pre-feasibility study and its technical report was based on a conceptual mine plan. And that conceptual mine plan had four major components. The first is the underground mine location, the Maturi and Maturi Southwest deposits that you see here in the upper right corner, highlighted in red. Secondly is the potential concentrator site, where the metals are separated within the mined ore. We're taking a look at a potential site west of the underground mines and south of the Ely Airport. Third is the potential location of our tailings storage facility and our transportation facility for our concentrate product. We're currently looking at a facility south of the city of Babbitt. And fourth would be the connecting corridors. The corridor to the west is conceived as an above-ground pipeline corridor moving tailings material and nickel and copper concentrates between the tailings storage facility and the concentrator. The small corridor between the concentrator and the underground mine is conceived as an underground decline or connection between the concentrator location and the underground mine. To Representative Serta's question, the blue line here, Representative, kind of in the lower third, that's the Laurentian Divide. So our mine project and the concentrator, potential concentrator location, are in the Rainy River watershed, north of the Laurentian Divide. The potential tailing storage facility is south of the Laurentian Divide and south of the city of Babbitt. This mine configuration was developed in, along with many other factors, some very important environmental principles in mind. One was to minimize surface impacts, and we're taking a look at putting as many operations and functions underground as we possibly can. Second is to take advantage of brownfield development opportunities where they exist. And third is, if brownfield development opportunities are not available, to locate facilities as close to other mining or industrial operations as are possible. And I'll point out, with the tailing storage facility, its proximity to the Peter Mitchell pit and other mining operations south of the city of Babbitt. Twin Metals is strongly committed to protecting Minnesota's natural environment. We have a strong corporate commitment to that fact. But the Twin Metals project overall is going to have to meet state and federal environmental standards or it won't be approved by those regulatory agencies. Those regulatory agencies will put our project, once we have proposed it, through rigorous environmental review. The permits, as Mr. Moore described the process, the permits that come after the EIS will include themselves very strict environmental standards. And I want to make very clear, the Twin Metals project will not pollute the waters of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. That is our corporate commitment. That is a fundamental principle. And the regulations and the regulatory agencies won't allow it. It simply will not happen. The agencies involved in our oversight are slightly different than those that are involved in the oversight of PolyMet, because we're dealing with federal minerals and we have a larger array of agencies that will oversee our project and run the environmental review process, including the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, tribal governments have a role, and then at the federal level, the U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, Army Corps of Engineers, and the Environmental Protection Agency, and there will be others throughout the process that will have a hand in our environmental review and the approval process. this is a typical EIS process as outlined. I'm borrowing this chart from the DNR and the PCA. And for context, I wanted to show where Twin Metals is in this long process. We're still in right near the end of the first box of this process. It's a multi-year box in and of itself. To put context to Mr. Morse, I know this is a little bit hard to read, but on the second line between the draft EIS and the final EIS, that is where the PolyMet project currently is. So we have a long way to go. By this chart alone, the minimum amount of time for our project to get to where PolyMet is today would be 4 years. And our project, with its complexity and sensitivity, will almost certainly take longer than that. And we understand that. But it's very important to understand this process, because it's through this process that our project will be further developed, further defined, will go through environmental analysis, and citizens and communities will have multiple opportunities through this process and through the permitting process to review the project and offer their own comments. And that's a very important part of this process that we are strongly supportive of. Our PFS report provide some job estimates based on the conceptual mine plan. Based on that conceptual mine plan, our project would generate about 850 full-time jobs when the project is in operation. It would generate approximately 12 million labor hours over a three-year construction period prior to operation. And for context, that 12 million labor hours is just about three times the number of labor hours that are estimated to take to build the Viking Stadium. The project would also provide or generate 1,700 to 1,900 additional spin-off jobs in the region because of the economic development and investment. And the jobs that we will generate will be anywhere from high school graduates, technical college, four-year degrees, and graduates. We have a broad spectrum of jobs that are necessary to support a modern mining operation. And as excited as we are about the jobs that we will generate in the future, our project development activities have been supporting jobs and economic development over the last several years. And here's just a partial list of the Minnesota companies that we have partnered with and very proud to partner with over the last years, several years in developing our project. We've also been working with local, state, and national educational organizations on the challenge of workforce development, and we're becoming very involved in that through DEED and through many of these other organizations to try to ensure that the workforce that we need for our project will be available and will be available to the industry in the long-term future. It's a strong, very important challenge. The PFS report also provides an estimate of the capital expenditures that it would take for the conceptual mine plan to be built. Prior to operation, we're looking at about $2.7 billion of capital investment into this project. During a 30-year life of mine plan, a time of period that is probably our permitting application in the future, we're looking at nearly $5.5 billion of investment and maintenance into that mine project. So far, Twin Metals and its joint venture partners have invested more than $250 million in project development activities to get the project to the point it is today. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I would like to take just a moment to address a couple of misconceptions about our project that you may have heard about or you may hear about yet today in the hearing. One is that that Twin Metals and its new full owner, Antofagasta, have a secret plan to abandon the underground mining project and turn it into an open pit project. That is not true. That is not fact. The pre-feasibility technical report and the pre-feasibility study was based on an underground mining operation, and it will remain so. Secondly, that possibly the Twin Metals Minnesota project has been proven to be economically unviable. That also is untrue. The pre-feasibility technical report included an independent third-party economic analysis of the project, and it was proven to be economically viable to move forward into the next stages of project development. And thirdly, as I have addressed, Mr. Chairman, that the Twin Metals project will pollute the waters of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. That simply will not happen. Mr. Chairman, again, thank you for this opportunity to provide some information about our project to the committee. Twin Metals is extremely proud and excited to be developing this world-class economic opportunity in the state of Minnesota. We are extremely grateful for the support that we have received from citizens and communities across the Iron Range, northern Minnesota, and throughout the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McFarland. First on the list for questions, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I know one of the things I've been frustrated with that's been out there publicly is the idea that it's 500 years of cleanup for 20 years of mining is what people are saying, what's on Facebook, social media. Some stickers in the audience here. To be clear, though, what really happened is someone applied for a permit, which requires a finite amount of time in it for the state to process what the regulations need to be. When you're looking at that 20-year permit for the other project, yours I know will be different, that's not the duration of the length of time that you would actually mine. Would it it'd be potentially open for another permit to continue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Metza, thank you. We're looking at a permit application in the future based on a 30-year mine plan. So it's a chunk of time where that you can reasonably project your operations, your environmental monitoring and impact. But we expect the Duluth Complex and our mine project to be able to be in mining operation for upwards of a century.
Representative Meza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I had.
Okay. Representative Corning.
Well, Pat, I was trying to get attention for Representative.
Okay. Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does the sulfide content of the ore from this mine compare with what we heard about for the PolyMet operation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Urizo, thank you for the question. We have not completed the definitive metallurgical studies on our deposits or on our tailings, but I can tell you that we're very encouraged by the preliminary work that was done in the pre-feasibility study as to a very low sulfur content both in our tailings and in our waste rock.
Representative Urizo.
Thank you. And in the map that you showed us, you talked about a surface pipeline for transporting ore to the...
I'm happy to go back to it, Representative.
Thank you. That pipeline crosses the west end of Birch, the stream attached to Birch Lake. Is that the inlet or the outlet of Birch Lake?
Mr. McFarland.
Representative Urizo, I'm sorry, I'm not clear on where exactly you're referring.
Your red line,
yes.
You described
as a surface
pipeline.
Yes.
And that blue squiggly thing is Birch Lake, the light blue squiggly thing.
Right.
The pipeline crosses what appears to me to be a stream at one end of Birch Lake. And the question is that the inlet or outlet of Birch Lake?
Depends on what side of the lake you live on.
Well, water flows in one direction or the other.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Urizo, first of all, in the concept of the pipeline, I'll just make it clear, the pipeline at that point would go under the water body. That would be the concept of that pipeline. As to your specific question, I should know the proper answer to that, and I'm sorry I don't, and I'll get back to you and make sure.
Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my concern is that at the other end of the lake, there is another stream, and we are sitting on the northeast side of the boundary between the watersheds. So we are on the Rainy River side, and if, as I suspect, that is the inlet, although I do not know that, the other end is the outlet, and the other end goes off into the boundary waters. And potential spills from pipelines are always a concern. So one quick question, Mr. Chair. When you said it would go under the lake, did you mean it would go in the ground under it or run through the water?
Tunneled under, Representative. In the concept, Representative Urizo, would be tunneled under.
Okay. Thank you. That's
okay. Any additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony today and your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good job. Thank you. Thank you for coming forward. Okay, members, we're going to take some testimony from some of the public that would like to testify. We have quite a number of folks that called in. I don't know that we'll get to everyone, but we will try to do that. We will take testimony for the same amount of time that we had testimony from the industry. Okay. 34 minutes was total? Okay. So 34 minutes total of public testimony. And the 34 minutes did not include the time that we had for questions. So that's why it's took more time. So with that, we'll start with Mr. Harry Melander. And up next after that is Tony Quillis. Mr. Harry Melander. Kate Lehman will be third. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record. Whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I will be brief. And I thank you for the opportunity today to talk about the non-ferrous industry, which presents a tremendous opportunity in terms of capital investment in the subsequent large economic development projects and the spin-off jobs and investments and benefits that come with it. The numbers alone, as you've heard here today, are just staggering. One project alone could create somewhere upwards of 500-plus direct and indirect jobs and over $515 million in taxes and royalties a year to the state for up to 20 to 30 years. The Chamber believes that there is also adequate local, state, and federal oversight through existing rules and statutes to regulate this industry while still protecting our environment and natural resources. Additionally, we believe that the current process provides ample public opportunity for comment and participation in the environmental review and permitting process. Mr. Chairman, just one example of the excitement and interest this past Friday up at Discovery World in Chisholm, there was a mining day, and there was an opportunity there for prospective employees to meet with the industry and the industry to meet with prospective employees in terms of diesel mechanics, project engineers, equipment operators, and there was hundreds of people there, Mr. Chairman, to show that the interest in this industry up in northern Minnesota. So the capital investment, the amount is, billions of dollars, and it's staggering. There's adequate regulation in place, Mr. Chairman, and there is, under the current system, adequate public input is available. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to stand for any questions, but I know there's a lot of people, and I'm here every day, so I'm willing to come back whenever. I'd like to turn it over to my friend, Mr. Melander.
Great. Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Good. Harry Melander, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Thanks for the opportunity today to briefly comment on, non-ferrous mining opportunities that exist in Minnesota today and for generations to come. As I indicated, my name is Harry Melander, and I work on behalf of 65,000-plus construction workers that reside throughout the Minnesota. And I always like to take the opportunity to tell you thank you for putting us back to work. 4 years ago, that wasn't the case, but we are very fortunate for all the good work that you've done over the last 4 years. So I just always like to show our appreciation. I'm here today with our partners from the business community, the state chamber, local chambers, in solidarity for the next generation of mining in Minnesota. Chair Hackbarth, I would like to thank you for taking the time to give this overview on non-ferrous mining. We believe that this new opportunity for the next generation of Iron Rangers can be done in a way that is considerate of our environment and optimistic in the rich employment opportunities that non-ferrous mining will bring to northeast Minnesota. These opportunities will provide northeastern Minnesota and other regions and others throughout the region a new chapter for mining in Minnesota. Mining has always been a way of life in northeastern Minnesota. Although we see Iron Range mining continuing its role on our northeast Minnesota economy, non-ferrous mining creates additional employment and regional growth for northeastern Minnesota and its cities. We believe and we expect that this next generation of mining will be some of the safest in the world. We have an opportunity to develop a way to extract these minerals different than any place in the world. We all depend on them for every part of our life, from green technology, from wind energy, from the phones we use, and the hybrid cars we drive. We believe, as all in the room should, that safe, respectful mining benefits all of us. Those that use the region for recreation, those that depend upon the region for ends meet, and those that require their minerals in their day-to-day activity. Safe processing, environmental protections, and sustainability point to a new generation of mining in Minnesota. Just saying no is not an option. We need these minerals, we need the jobs, and we need to do it right. Let's continue to move this conversation and the process forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you very much for coming in. Thank you for your
testimony.
Thank you, sir. Kate Lehman? Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Kate Lehman, and I represent the private Minnesota companies Vermilion Gold and Beaver Bay. Vermilion Gold is exploring for gold in the greenstone belts of northern Minnesota, and Beaver Bay owns a minority interest in the Twin Metals Project. Each of these companies represents a different stage of investment in mineral development. Vermilion Gold is a junior explorer, taking the highest risk by spending on initial exploration. And if there is promise, a junior will often partner with a larger company that has the financial resources to take the project to the next level, but is unwilling to take on early risk. Beaver Bay is much further along. Its founders were instrumental in leading the development of non-ferrous mining in the Duluth complex. Over 30 economically bumpy years, Beaver Bay continued exploring, financed by joint ventures with large and small mining companies. The most recent changes in ownership of Twin Metals have resulted in our partnership with Antofagasta, which you see as a global giant. Over the decades, each of these new investments advanced the viability of a state-of-the-art mining operation and put money into Minnesota. It all started with reviewing legacy samples at the DNR's Hibbing Core Library and leasing 63 acres of mineral rights for $300. We now predict the investment in Twin Metals will exceed $3 billion by the time production begins. I believe that our state can achieve substantial long-term benefits by supporting early-stage investment and staying the course. It can do this by minimizing obstacles to exploration and helping us compete in a very challenging global mining marketplace where the playing field is anything but level. Providing agency support and keeping state royalty and tax rates competitive are two important ways to support industry development. At present, exploration dollars are very hard to come by, but Twin Metals and PolyMet are both excellent examples of what can happen in the long term when early exploration is encouraged and supported. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you very much for coming in. Questions, members? Next up is Betsy Dobb. Thank you for coming in. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. My name is Betsy Dobb, and I am the Policy Director with Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. And Chairman Hackbarth and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. Last August, the Mount Polly copper gold mine in British Columbia experienced a catastrophic release of toxic tailings waste when the tailings dam broke, and 2 billion gallons of contaminated waste flooded the surrounding forests and lakes. It has been called the worst disaster in Canadian mining history. There are some disturbing similarities between the Mount Polly mine and the proposed PolyMet sulfide mine in Minnesota. And this informational hearing is an opportunity to start an important discussion about how we ensure that a Mount Polly type disaster does not happen here in our state. An independent investigation into the Mount Polly disaster reveals that the primary cause was that the design of the tailings basin did not take into account an underlying deposit of glacial till because it was never fully mapped and it was assumed to be sufficiently compacted. It was not. We're alarmed that the engineering company that designed the failed basin, Knight Piesold, has also been working on the PolyMet basin design. In addition, an independent expert's evaluation of PolyMet's tailings basin has criticized PolyMet for relying on unsupported assumptions of well-compacted substrate and for selecting a tailings basin dam design that poses the highest risk for seismic and static failure. This is a map in your packet of a simulated tailings breach for the PolyMet project. The Mount Poly investigation recommends in the strongest terms that new mines cease using water-based storage and move to a disposal method called dry stacking in order to prevent this kind of toxic flood in the future. But PolyMet's tailings basin is the more dangerous water-based storage type. The Mount Poly mine was once hailed as the gold standard of sulfide mines, where sulfide mining was done right without impacts to the environment. And they were wrong. We in Minnesota do not want, cannot afford, this kind of a scene in our precious northern Minnesota forests and lakes. We urge the legislature to review the Mount Poly report and implement its recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Metzl was first. Representative Metzl.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Enzo. Manzo.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Metzl. I don't believe there's anybody on this panel that isn't concerned about the Mount Poly experience. But, Mr. Chairman, I think at some point here it would really be appropriate to hear from the DNR about what steps, what procedures and processes will be followed through at PolyMet to prevent the very same thing that the witness is mentioning. So I don't know if you want to do that now or at some later date, but we do have to get to the bottom of that.
And Representative Anzell, we can do that. I think today's not the day for it. We've got a lot of public testimony to take. But we do want to have the DNR speak to that. I think they're in the audience, but we'll take that at another time. We'll let the public speak today. Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you briefly tell me what dry stacking is?
It is a method of storing the waste where they're dry, as opposed to mixing them with water the way the PolyMet design has been planned. And that way you won't get tailings dam breach, won't just sort of inundate the surrounding environment with the water carrying those contaminated wastes along with it.
Representative Mesa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, do you have any scientific data that has a long history of study with regard to the dry storage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think that's an excellent question. I'm not the technical expert. I encourage you to ask those kinds of questions of PolyMet and of the DNR.
Representative Russo, do you have something?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. In order for us to really evaluate this, you know, we would need to know more what you mean by the dry stacking. The concern I know is, you know, you would somehow have to make that waterproof if you're going to keep things dry. And we've corresponded about the Mount Poly disaster, and I did look into that a little bit. I would welcome the comments from the DNR about it. I think, though, just for the sake of just the moment, there are some pretty significant differences in the design between the Mount Poly storage and the PolyMet. So it would be good. It'll be great when we hear about that from the DNR, mm-hmm. I think.
So, Representative Urusso, would you like the DNR to come up now and speak to that, or could we do that at another time?
Oh, another time.
We've got a long list of public testimony.
You're doing it's fine with me.
I'd really like to take care of that. Thank you very much for your
thank
testimony.
You.
Thank you for coming in. Let's see. Next on the list is Gordon and Heather Meyer. Thank you for coming in today.
Good afternoon. Thank
Please
you very much.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Heather Meyer, and I'm actually a private citizen. I'm a landowner in Ely, Minnesota,
and I'm here to talk to you about the impact to private citizens from these proposals. My family owns 5 acres of land and a log home on Eagle's Nest 3 in Eagle's Nest Township. That's about 15 miles south of Ely. And we're located between two states, one of our state parks. One of them is Bearhead Lake State Park, so it's quite a beautiful area. And obviously, I care deeply about that Wilderness Edge community. And what I'd ask you to think about today is some of the costs to these proposals. We've heard a lot of the benefits. I'm in business in my day-to-day life, and I know we have to look at both sides. And I believe you can't implement a mining district in the middle of what is currently a resort, campground, and personal property rich wilderness area without displacing some very important components of that existing economy and impacting families in a very personal way. And I'm here to tell you about the personal way my family would be impacted by mining in this region. I'd like you to keep in mind that there are thousands of private property owners that own lake homes, wilderness homes in the watershed of the Boundary Waters. So I'm speaking specifically about north of the Laurentian Divide proposals in the watershed of the Boundary Waters. There's thousands of residents that own homes there, and we don't own our mineral interests for the most part, okay? My family story is like many other up north cabin stories, maybe like some of yours. This is my dad. We bought our land 30 plus years ago, and for the past 30 years have really spent our time, energy, and money building an absolutely spectacular, beautiful place, his legacy, and the place I'd like to live full time. Everything changed about 4 years ago when we were notified that the state had sold our personal, the subsurface property interests to a mining company. We're talking about here the impact of eminent domain if mining starts to be something that we're choosing to do in the watershed of the Boundary Waters, and it's something that you need to consider. Our township has about 800 properties worth over $125 million, and we have an eminent domain cloud hanging over our head at this time. It's the worst kind of eminent domain because we're talking about private mining companies. And we're talking about not fair, necessarily fair compensation and not consent. So it's the worst kind. The result of such choices would obviously be losing our legacy and our personal wealth and the heartbreak, obviously, of the destruction of property. So my request to you today is quite simple. I'd like you to understand all the impacts of these mining proposals. There are thousands of people who call this wilderness area their home. When you're showing the complexes and the maps up, those are people's houses when they show the Twin Metals proposal. So please take the time and understand what displacing private property owners is going to do to the economy up there. We feel like we're pretty important. My request of you is to protect the Boundary Waters watershed permanently from mining and preserve its clean water, forests, and the Wilderness Edge community. In closing, I'd really like to, my closing comments is, this is a question in my mind about what is the best long-term sustainable plan for that region and for our state. Is it really the best choice to turn the watershed of the most popular wilderness area in our country into a mining district? I'm here fighting for my home. I urge you to say no.
That's quiet. Have the quorum in the hearing. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
I'm Gordon Meyer. I'm Heather's father, and I'm the landowner of the property in Ely. I'm here today to voice my opposition and concern about the state of Minnesota selling mineral interests on private land and then having the ability to invoke eminent domain on a private landowner's property that would allow someone to come in and mine. I am totally opposed to the state legislature even considering allowing sulfide mining to take place in this pristine wilderness watershed area. Decisions about sulfide mining need to be based upon scientific, environmental, and economic fact. The history, past and present, on sulfide mining practices shows that sulfide mining has never been done successfully anywhere in North America without causing huge water and landscape pollution issues that take hundreds of years, if not forever, to fix. I would ask the state legislator and related agencies to ensure that the in-depth EIS, and I call EEIS, environmental economic impact study be done and reviewed before any further consideration of sulfide mining is allowed. The BWCA watershed is a valuable national heritage and needs to be forever protected from the threat of sulfide mining. I appreciate your time today, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have questions
we've
for
got
us?
A few questions.
Yeah, please.
And you guys took together about 5 minutes, so
yep.
Just so you know. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would have a question. I recently had some constituents who, for a different mining project, had purchased some property, the surface rights anyway.
Yep. That's what it is, yep.
I do think we need to take a look at some of this, but I did want to clarify, when you purchased the property, there was probably
yes.
knowledge of some sort that you did not own
that's
the mineral
correct.
Rights?
Yeah, and probably most of you, I'm sure you already know this, but most landowners in that area don't own their subsurface mineral interests. That's why I'm urging you to take that into consideration, because there is an eminent domain and private property thing going on here that absolutely needs to be addressed.
The problem also is, in our particular case, the company that had the lease on our property, they, as you heard today, they decided they wouldn't continue on. So they turned it back to the DNR, and the DNR then turned again and re-auctioned it. And we ended up 4 years ago, 3 years ago now, finding out it had been sold. And that's where the issue comes with private landowners. We have no say in the process whatsoever.
And we can't buy our own leases.
And we can't buy our own minerals rights.
Interesting.
And the way this it's set up, they don't have, I mean, they can come in and issue eminent domain or condemn your property and you get nothing for it.
Yeah.
And they can mine within 100 feet of my facility. That's where the issue as a private landowner becomes real personal.
Representative Metzler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I do sympathize with the situation, but, you know, to point out for the public, you know, it's much bigger than just the current, you know, eminent
Absolutely.
Domain. This
Correct.
Is something you did knowingly sign
yep.
into, just like our family did yep. when we got our land
Absolutely.
Many years ago.
That's exactly
yep.
right.
Gave away that and knowingly signed away, you know, our yep. mineral rights access and knew that something could come up like this.
Yes.
Yep. Representative Moline.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
I'm sorry,
Chair. And
question.
You know, I just wanted to comment to the testifiers, you know, we live on the Iron Range, so do our families, that's our permanent homes, and so we don't own the mineral rights under our homes either.
So you could have my story.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess, you know, to Representative Metz's point is, when you purchased your land, you were well aware that you didn't own the mineral rights. You know, the house I live in Hibbing had been moved in from a mining location years ago. It's very common. You know, historically on the Iron Range that homes
yes.
have moved due to mining, et cetera. So, you know, we just want to make clear for the public this isn't a situation where you were, you know, unaware that you didn't own the
Fair.
Mineral rights under
That's
your
correct.
Yes, that is correct.
Land. And, Mr. Chair, I also just wanted to point out, you know, I know there was, you know, some comments and applause, and just to remind the audience and the public that we're here for an informational hearing on non-ferrous mining. There's no pending legislation. We, as a committee, aren't here to either approve or
Absolutely.
Disapprove of non-ferrous mining. It's in the regulatory process where it belongs. We're just here simply for an overview on mining.
Yep.
So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Moline. That's exactly correct.
Thank
Representative
you.
Constantine.
Thank you.
The gentleman, thank you, Mr. Chair. The gentleman stated that sulfuric mining has never been done successfully. Could we have
without
polluting,
without pollution and contamination?
Could we ask House Research to take a look at that and give us a report?
I think we heard some testimony earlier that was contrary. So
I would ask you to get some independent research, if I may be so bold, and not just what we're saying or what the mining companies are saying, but maybe some independent.
Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to, you know, point out again. I think I had mentioned mm-hmm. this earlier. We're very proud of the standards that we have in our communities for the type of work we do. And we've got the highest percent, or I should say, let me back up here. The folks who work at the mines in my district produce more tonnage per man hour than anywhere else in the world. We fought for the standards, health care, and a contract with our steel workers, some of which are in the audience here. Those wouldn't be in our day-to-day lives. Our district helped get a lot of the laws that are protecting the environment, the worker. And so we'd respectfully ask like you're asking the companies to follow the process for the public too. One, it's not sulfide mining. We don't have a single exploration project for sulfide in our district. So respectfully, I'd ask that it would be referred to as non-ferrous mining. But secondly, no, this is where we come from. We want to see it done right. Again, what Representative Moline said, we live and work back home. And on Thursday night, the second I can get out of St. Paul and see Representative Sundin, no offense, cloquet in my rearview mirror, I'm in good shape. But overall, you know, we do have an issue here where we've got a controversial project, and we're just asking that the process be respected on both sides, that it's treated, all industry is treated fairly, and right now we feel like mining is being isolated out as this one industry who pollutes. And I can't think of one hole I dug when I was a kid in my sandbox that was clean. So, you know, we all got to understand as a society, the way we live, digging a hole isn't clean. You don't, you know, not get mud on your hands digging a hole. So and we do it the best we can.
And we don't have a taconite mining. This is not about that. So I just, so all saying I'm not against mining. So that's a black and white statement as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Members and folks in the audience, this committee is going to end at 4:30. That's the end of our time every day that we have this hearing. And we have 17 more people from the public that would like to speak. So we'll move on. When we run out of time, we run out of time. Let's see. Bob Taman? Am I pronouncing that right?
Taman.
Oh, welcome. Nice to see you again. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
I'm Bob Taman from Sudan, Minnesota. I spent several years working in the mines, and then when the jobs weren't too plentiful, I'd come down here and work for XL Energy, so I thank the good people in the metro for a few paychecks. I know you've seen so much paperwork, but I bought another little handout. Items of interest, the first is a public notice for the Army Corps of Engineers to fill the wetlands. And what I thought was interesting is the back side of that page, which documents that Hibbing Taconite has a 1,000-foot crack in their dike, which perhaps wasn't life-threatening in that situation, but I thought it was newsworthy, and what surprised me is I never saw it in the news. If somebody hadn't sent me this little permit application, I wouldn't have known about it, and I doubt if many other people know that we have serious dike problems in Minnesota. All of the taconite tailings pond dikes in the Mesabi Range are leakers, including Polymets, which is leaking about 2.9 million gallons a day right now, even though there's no mining going on there, degrading the Embarrass River. I've gone out there with a conductivity meter. The readings are elevated. The second page is a percentage depletion definition from the Minnesota Mining Tax Guide, which you've seen referenced here before. A lot of numbers come out of that tax guide. What I thought was interesting is that I've heard mining company promoters say that that ore isn't worth anything until they mine it, but they're willing to take a 15% depletion allowance after they ship it out of state, leaving behind the waste rock in our tailings pond, ground to the consistency of face powder, shipping the iron out of our communities. Other numbers we picked up in previous testimony and we've heard mentioned today, $119 million paid by the mining company in state and local taxes, and I think, no, it's a pretty good-sized number. However, this week you've already heard about the governor's budget proposal, and it's considerably more than $30 billion a year for Minnesota's budget. So then when you start doing the percentages and you accept testimony from January 21st that they paid $119 million for the mining industry, and you figure out what a percentage that is of our budget, it's less than 0.5%. So we're degrading over 100 miles of northern Minnesota in mining. That's the length of the Mesabi Iron Range for less than 0.5% of our budget. The last page I thought was interesting. We heard on January 21st and today about the Labovitz School of Business, the wonderful economic study they did, and there's some surprising information, if you read it, that ferrous and non-ferrous mining creates about 2,400 more jobs in the metro and other parts of the state than the Arrowhead region in Douglas County, Wisconsin. What he's saying is that, according to their study, mining creates more jobs in the metro than it does in northern Minnesota. And being I've occasionally had a job in the metro, I shouldn't complain about that, but you know, we're trying to help out rural Minnesota. And I think the people in the metro would agree. Why should we destroy 1,000 acres of Minnesota's wetlands to create the majority of the jobs in the metro? And of course, people will say, if you don't like mining, what's your substitution? And that's probably a fair question. And perhaps I'm not the right person to ask for that, being I am in my 70s. Younger people should answer that question, but I think we should have an alternative to mining. And the first one I would suggest, not only to this committee, but to the whole legislature, let's have some decent PILT, payment in lieu of taxes. We know the people in the metro like to come up and visit us and use our natural resources for entertainment, and occasionally they send us PILT dollars. And I can tell you, my wife and I live in Brighton Township, we like PILT dollars. So instead of trying to permit more global mining industry boondoggles in our backyard, send us some PILT dollars. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Tomlin. Representative Anzelk.
Mr. Chairman and members, I can assure you, I don't want to create any jobs in the metro.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's see, who's up next? Mr. Backstrom? You're up next, and I have to tell you, folks, Mr. Tomlin, it took about 4.5 minutes. We've given everybody, we told everybody in advance, 2 minutes. We're going to be running out of time at 4:30, so let's try to keep it to 2 minutes.
I'll try that.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom.
Thank
please,
you, Mr.
Please
Chairman.
State your name for the record.
Yes, Dick Backstrom, and I'm with Idea Drilling. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Dick Backstrom. I'm the CEO of Idea Drilling. Our company is headquartered in Virginia, Minnesota. My wife, Pam, and I founded Idea Drilling in 1997 and moved to Minnesota from Montana in 1998. Idea provides bedrock drilling and downhole survey services, mainly for the mining industry and exploration industry. We started Idea with 2 drills and now have 20 drills. We started our company with 3 employees and now we have 120 employees. We do most of the drilling, the exploration drilling for these projects and for the taconite mines in northern Minnesota. As a frame of reference, our drillers earn from $70,000 to $100,000 per year. Most of them are high school graduates. Our helpers, which is our starting base, earn between $35,000 and $55,000 a year. When I visit one of our drill crews in the field and ask them what we as management can do, always the answer is, keep us working, please. The key points I'd like to make is that Idea Drilling is a representative of many small and medium-sized companies in Minnesota, and is built around the support of the mineral exploration and mining business. Decisions made here by the legislature have a direct impact on our business and our employees. We appreciate the opportunity to provide input on legislative issues. We ask that state-owned land continue to be made available for mineral leasing. The juniors and the companies that do that use our services to explore and to decide whether the property is worth pursuing. And we would ask that you ensure that there is thorough and timely environmental review on mineral projects in Minnesota. We would also like for you to know that we are committed to minimizing and mitigating or eliminating our impacts on environment in how we conduct bedrock drilling. To illustrate the commitment, we have produced this booklet, and I think we handed this booklet out to you. Drilling is sort of a niche business, and not many people know what the process is, but this goes through the process and shows what we do in the process of doing exploration drilling. Minnesota has many regulations in place for exploration drilling, and we support those measures to protect our environment and groundwater. IDEA has gone beyond those requirements to address noise reduction, spill prevention, prevent the spread of non-native invasive species, and light pollution. And we appreciate the chance to talk to the committee this afternoon, both me and our employees.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Questions? Representative Mesa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I was going to let the public know. I went on a tour with this company over, well, a couple tours now, and I think everyone in the room would be impressed with the work that you and the team does in terms of what you just outlined. And when you go into an area, they're not kidding. They rinse off the tires and everything on their way out, making sure that there's, you know, nothing leaving. The noise pollution where we were currently was in a cabin similar to the one described today on a previous testimony. And you made sure to work with the homeowners and work on that noise and then the light pollution as well. So I just wanted to say, you know, thank you for the work that you've been doing. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Thank you for coming down today. Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Mayor Scalpin. Mark Scalpin. Again, Mayor, if you could keep your comments brief, we're running short of time.
Good afternoon, almost evening.
Please state your name and who you represent.
My name is Mark Skelton. I'm the mayor of White Lakes, Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives, for this opportunity. I've had the opportunity for the past 3 days to be here in St. Paul, or actually in the past three out of the past 6 days. And I know you guys might be frustrated with what's going on down here, but for me it's pretty awesome to see the economic development driving around the city, the people working. Somebody told me last week that the unemployment rate in this region is 3%, and I could not be happier for this area of the state. But what I would do is ask or extend an invitation to each and every one of you that are here today that are not familiar with my area of the state, and I think we can paint a little bit different picture. I think right now our unemployment rate is arguably between 6 and 8%. But we are the Iron Range, and I can tell you that we're not going to complain. We're not going to complain about what's going on, because we have been mining up there on the Iron Range for over 100 years. That was before there was regulatory agencies. And so I have to tell you that in all modesty, our citizens do a darn good job. We are good at what we do. And the proof is in the pudding, because without the regulatory agencies and the 100 years of mining, we still have pristine lakes, we have still pristine rivers and beautiful forests. So that being said, we have an opportunity here. The town that I represent, we're a mining town without a mine. You heard it earlier today, we lost our mine in 2001. I'm not here to shed tears over that, because for over 50 years, that mine took care of our citizens and provided good jobs. But we have an opportunity to move into the future with this non-ferrous mining. And we have this opportunity that we have regulating agencies that will be able to keep a close eye. We have a company that, in my belief, really does care about the environment. These are good folks. So we have this opportunity to make the changes that we need to do and do this right. The part that gets me, I have a hard time getting my mind around this, is that we want clean energy. We saw today what it takes in these non-ferrous metals to make clean energy. We want the medical devices to keep us alive and to sustain a quality of life. We all want catalytic converters on our cars to clean up our emissions from our vehicles. And if you look around the room, I couldn't help but think before I come down here, we want all them toys. We want our iPads, we want our cell phones, and we want our computers. I don't want to take them away from anybody, but some of us don't care where we do this or how we do this. We can do it in other parts of the world with no regulations, or we can do it here, and we can do it right with our regulators making sure that it's right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Skull. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for coming down today. Let's see. Next on the list, Dave Leiselgard. Aurora City Council member. Thank you for coming in. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Dave Leiselgard, and I represent the City of Aurora. My name is Dave Leiselgard, and I am a third-generation miner, and I'm also currently serving as a councilman for the City of Aurora. I was a young father with a young family when I lost my job back in 2001 when the LTV steel plant closed. Our daughter Haley at the time was 7 years old. And I remember very vividly the fear and anxiety that I felt knowing that I had a young family to support and I didn't know how I was going to do it. Then in 2005, a sense of hope swept through our communities with the announcement that PolyMet had purchased the LTV site with plans to develop a mine and reopen the plant. And honestly, just the idea of it provided hope for the future. The thought of hundreds of new jobs and the revitalization that it would bring was huge, but it has been a very long slog. 14 years later, that 7-year-old daughter that I mentioned earlier is now 21. And I sit before you very proud and honored to tell you that she has recently completed a certification to be a heavy equipment operator, and she is ready. But PolyMet, sadly, still waits its permits. Mining is a way of life in our rural Minnesota. And that history and those traditions run as deep as the minerals under our feet. And we are very proud of what we do. Minnesota mines already produce, and in PolyMet's case, will produce, the very resources that will help bring about the clean energy economy the nation and state is asking for. Minnesota is a leader in clean energy, and it also can be a leader in the next age of non-ferrous mineral mining. We have every confidence in the state and federal environmental agencies. We believe in the permitting process, and we are aware that this project, as currently designed, will meet all requirements to protect our air and water. And in closing, let me say, this state and our region, we are blessed that these resources are here, the technology is here, and the workforce is here. And now the time has come to end the 10-plus year debate and put our families to work. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions, members? Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for coming in. Next on the list is Rebecca Rahm. Thank you for coming in.
Please state
your name and who you represent for the record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Becky Rahm. I live in Ely, Minnesota. I'm a third-generation Elyite. My grandfather was a miner. My written testimony has been submitted, and in respect of the time and other people who want to speak, I'm not going to repeat what's in my testimony. I would like to say that I can answer the question on which direction the water flows in Birch Lake. I can tell you the sulfide content of the ore in the Twin Metals deposit. I can tell you about the modeling that demonstrates under the ordinary operation of Twin Metals that it will pollute the boundary waters. I can tell you about why the Twin Metals project is not currently economically viable in the light of market analysts and the market has spoken. And I can talk to you about the misleading comments that Mr. McFarland made to you about the underground mine. I'm going to start with the photograph, and so any of those questions you want answered, I will answer them for you. Right now you're getting a photograph. That is a photo of the intersection of the South Kuishewi River and Birch Lake. What you are looking at in the upper right-hand side is the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Twin Metals is proposing to mine four deposits, one of which butts up against the Boundary Waters, immediately adjacent to two very popular entry points into the wilderness. One of its deposits is directly across from the Voyager Outward Bound School, 50 years old. It takes hundreds of young people, of veterans, of a lot of other people into the wilderness from that site. Right in the middle of your photograph is River Point Resort and Outfitting Company. That resort, when it looks out on the horizon, in your bottom right-hand side of the picture, will look on this. First, it will look upon the 1,000-acre concentrator site for Twin Metals. That was shown on Mr. McFarland's photo. It will operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. It will have surface crushing of ore. Lights, industrial lights, will shine all the time. It will create air pollution, noise pollution, water pollution. Immediately to the south of the concentrator site is Maturi Southwest. I've read that 550-page technical document that Mr. McFarland refers to. And that document says Maturi Southwest will likely be mined to the surface. That's not an underground mine. That's an open pit mine. And it lies immediately adjacent to a Forest Service campground. In the vicinity, what you're looking at in that photo are 26 resorts, outfitting business, camps, and campgrounds. The majority of those businesses listed on the Ely Chamber of Commerce website. It sits amidst hundreds of homes that are valued by St. Louis County and Lake County for real estate tax purposes at $318 million. Studies have shown that property values are higher when they're next to a pristine wilderness area. This wilderness area is the most popular wilderness area in the country. More people visit it than any other wilderness area and have for 50 years. People have been surveyed in Ely and asked why they live there. They've been surveyed in the townships around Ely. The number one reason is the boundary waters, and almost a quarter of them say they will leave if mining comes. The Ely Chamber of Commerce advertises Ely as the last great pure experience. We are a wilderness edge community. We are not a mining community. We have 33 resorts, 23 outfitting businesses, 5 dog sled outfitting businesses. If this mine happens, you will displace the existing economy of Ely, and that displacement will occur throughout the wilderness edge. So the cost of this mine is the loss of our existing economy. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems to me you know quite a bit about mining. Maybe we should have a different committee hearing and get those answers at some point. But I did have a question where, you know, as lawmakers, we make tough decisions about jobs and attracting businesses. Do you know the average wage of Ely employee during and the duration of employment?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Metza. I can tell you the median household income for Ely, it's $48,000. That is more than 20% higher than the mining communities on the Iron Range. So we do quite well by rural economic standards.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know how many employees who live in Ely are actual miners?
Ms. Rahm.
Well, I hate to admit this, but the last underground mine in Ely, and they're very small by today's standards, closed the year I graduated from high school. That was 1967. So that's the last time we could lay claim to being a mining town. I will tell you, though, that friends of mine from high school that live there commute to Minntac and to other mines. But they live in Ely, and they live in Ely for a reason, and that's because they love living there and love recreating there. And they want to keep those waters pristine, which the water pollution, the water quality standards don't achieve. And they want to keep those forests beautiful so they can go snowmobiling and hunting. So they commute.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're out of time. Representative Dill?
Okay. I think, Mr. Chairman, that it's a better question to ask, why don't the people live in Ely? There's 22-plus storefronts that are closed. The Pizza Hut closed. The number one most important thing to the Vermilion Community College basketball team, and it closed because they could really afford those pizzas. It's most important to understand what has happened to the school population. I heard some folks here in my district, and they're constituents of mine, that were talking about the leases and the underground, the subsurface leases. But I don't recall them or Ms. Rahm advocating for my family when the boundary waters came along and usurped all the private property rights and sent all of the businesses in Voyagers Park and the boundary waters down the road. In fact, frankly, the community of Ely has reduced and reduced and reduced like on a giant diet. And they have had 51 years since the 64 Wilderness Act, and they've had 34 years since the 78 Wilderness Act to replace that with a viable tourism industry. And the tourism industry, there's a group in Ely that's called Sustainable Ely, and they meet and they work hard at what they do. But sustainable is not sustainable in the ways that people in Ely thought about 40 years ago. It's a much lower sustainability. Now it's nice and pleasant, and you got beautiful view sheds and clean water, and I live on that, and I'm happy about that. But I also get the part about the economics. And the Boundary Waters Care Center is ready to shut down. We gave them a lifeline last year from the legislature to keep them home. The hospital's in peril. They don't deliver babies in Ely anymore. I mean, there's a lot of things that have happened because of a region of this tourism industry. That's great, but we need something else. Now, if it's not mining, what is it? What is the alternative?
And if I may answer your question, Representative.
Very quickly, we're out of time.
Two manufacturing businesses are now in the process of expansion. Developer John Ott has bought six of those buildings that are vacant on the main street, and two of them are opening again this spring. Incredible Ely, a grassroots movement, is developing new programs for Ely. The community center is in redevelopment. We're doing it ourselves from the ground up and internally. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Oh. Please keep some decorum in the committee hearing. Members, tomorrow we'll hear on a presentation on iron ore mining. Meeting is adjourned.